Welcome to the June 2009 Space Coast meeting. Would you all please rise to the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have a couple of new members this morning. We have two businesses, Burlingham Structural Engineering. Is anyone here from Burlingham? And another one, Bovier and Associates, a CPA. Today we're going to cut pretty much through the business section. We have an announcement that we'd like to make, which is up on the screen. That's the new Space Coast website. We've designed it in such a way to make it very senior friendly, and it gives you a lot of the links and the information that you need to go to directly. So you can find out all about us. You can find out about the board of directors, who they are for contact. If you need information, just click onto the contact site. For members, what is going on? You have the join, which is all the different applications. You can click them and download them and take care of that. We have a legislative section, which is we post as much of the pertinent information as it comes. Then you have your trade show, which is pictures and your slideshow and or video of the trade shows, the different shows that we had. The program list, which is where you'll find all the information regarding the yearly programs. You can find out the upcoming, the last, listen to them, and you also have a President's Forum information. The full business directory, you can download, it'll download right to your computer, and that is updated on a weekly basis, more or less. The link section is quite interesting. It'll send you and take you any place you need that is pertinent to you. 718, 719, and it takes you right to the appropriate places that would most benefit the associations. And you have a lot of other information sites and news sites that are in there. All the information that is posted pertains to co-ops, condos, homeowner associations, pretty much everything that you guys need is in here, and we're keeping it as simple as possible and as open as possible. If for some reason you're wandering around the website and you get a little confused, just hit the SCCA logo. It'll always bring you back to the home page, no matter where you are. Okay? And we've also incorporated, we're presenting for the first time the new another new name for Space Coast. We are presently, everybody is aware, Space Coast Condominiums Association, but we are opening it up to Space Coast Communities Association also to let these HOAs, co-ops, all the other people that we do represent understand that we are not just condominiums. So I hope it makes it easy for you. I hope you enjoy it. It can now be accessed from the regular website of Space Coast, www.spacecoastcondo.com, or by a new link, which is www.scca-online.org. There's numerous sites in there, numerous addresses, but they will be the two primary addresses that will take you right into that site. There's also tabs inside the site as you're going through. If you see something while you're in there that is not working correctly or you have an issue with, click the tab. It'll give you an email, and you can send it directly to us, and we'll take care of the issues. Okay? The next President's Forum meeting will be on July 11th at 10 a.m. Clay, thank you. You can leave it on if you want. Now, as far as today's program goes, It's our pleasure to have a very distinguished speaker. He really doesn't need any introduction. But he'll be speaking on the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act. And he is internationally known as an authority on common interest ownership. He's also known for a lot of his published columns in several newspapers throughout Florida. His articles on disaster planning and recovery. And that's just to name a few. He also has a new book coming out in August of this year, which is named The New Neighbors of Consumer Guide to Condo, Co-op, and HOA Living. And this is a down-to-earth conversational book on for information for boards of directors, and we believe that you probably should, every board member should have a copy of this book. It is currently available for pre-order on Amazon.com. And if you need any more information, feel free to email me and I can send you any information you need. After the presentation, he will be addressing questions that have been submitted by our President's Forum during a question and answer period. And I think everybody will get quite a bit out of today's meeting. And with that being said, I would like to introduce our speaker, Mr. Gary Polyakov from the law firm Becker & Polyakov.
I have to be wired first.
If you don't wire them, you can't walk.
Sure. Thank you. Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, and thanks. We've become so technical. I'm impressed. I'm impressed with the website. First thing right out of the box, I regret I wasn't able to be here for Harry Charles. It's a retirement. But I want to also commend Harry. Where's Harry? There's Harry over there. He's a man who accomplished so much for shared ownership in this state, an individual who was always present to advocate legislative changes that were in the interests of not only the boards, but the whole concept, unit owners, to ensure that there was a balance in place. I could always be assured that when there was any type of a gathering in Tallahassee, Harry would be there. And most importantly, of course, is the Space Coast Condo Association that he was a formative person in, because the most important aspect of shared ownership is education for people to understand the nature of the concept, their rights and responsibility for it to work. So, Harry, I commend you, and I look forward to seeing you. I will be back up here on, I think it's September 26th. I've been invited to, I think it's the Monarch Country Club, where I'll be doing book signing of my new book, New Neighborhoods, The Consumer's Guide to Condominium, Co-op, and HOA Living. And just as was just indicated, the only thing is it's not written just for members of the board. This is really, as a reporter I spoke to last night said, this is a book that every person who lives in a shared ownership community really should have. And I hope that's the case. It was written conversationally. It's not a legal treatise. I'm the author of a two-volume legal treatise with Wes, a group for lawyers. That's not what this book is. This book is a book that everyone in the room, lawyer or non-lawyer, could pick up and read and understand more fully their rights and their responsibilities as a owner in a shared ownership community. I've been asked, and another thing I also want to comment about it. I'm humbled by the response I received to the column I write that appears in your Sunday paper. My column appears in about 15 papers around the state of Florida, and I receive 2,000 to 3,000 letters each year. It's humanly impossible to be able to respond to all of them. I mean, I would like to. I would love Florida Today and the other papers, Palm Beach Post, Daytona New Journal. I'd rather than just say Florida Today, the columns of Gary Polyakov, and the whole paper be full of it, but maybe it would be full of it. But obviously that's not possible. There's a allocated amount of space, and I try to answer as many as possible. Quite frankly, that's why I ended up writing New Neighborhoods. So many people wrote in and said, when are you going to write a book that maybe we could go to? And so there were so many of those letters. I said, you know, it's time to do so. And I elicited the support of my son, Ryan. And Ryan's really the writer. I write legally. He was able to synthesize all this legal mumbo-jumbo and make it very conversational. And so when we come up here on the 26th, we'll look forward to speaking to you about the concept in the book. I do want to mention that if you have an opportunity to read New Neighborhoods during the summer, just bring it out on the 26th. You don't have to wait to buy it on the 26th. It is available now on Amazon.com. And quite frankly, they discounted them out of the chute at prices that I don't understand how they would sell it at that. But they get it through the distributors and the discounter, and that's just the way it is. The book retails for $16.95. They already have it, I think, for $11.53. So it's, I'm thinking about buying it there to resell. I think they do better than I can do. I've been asked today to speak about uniformity in the laws. And I've done something for you. It was actually initially prepared. It was updated for the Cluster Housing Workshop. Cluster Housing is sponsored by the University of Miami School of Law, and I was asked to speak this past year on whether it's time to uniform the laws of Florida dealing in shared ownership. You know, when we talk the term shared ownership, we're talking about condominium cooperative and homeowner associations. And the concepts are basically the same. They're splintered out into condominium where there's two basic components, the unit and the common elements. There's a mandatory membership association that everyone is compulsory a member of as a condition of owning in the community. There's a cooperative, of course, where the individuals own shares of stock in the corporation. The corporation, in turn, owns the property. And there is a homeowner association where there is individual lot ownership and common areas which are either restricted in the plat or site plan, but everybody as a condition of living in the community has to be a member of the association. So when I use the word shared ownership, other times you'll hear others refer to as common interest ownership. I always found common interest ownership to be a little confusing, so in New Neighborhoods, I've actually come up with a new term, which is shared ownership communities, or SOC, S-O-C. If you hear me use the term SOC, it includes all three forms, condominiums, HOAs, and cooperatives. In my mind, there is really no distinction without a real difference. I don't understand why there are three different bodies of law. The Uniform Common Ownership Housing Law has been adopted either in its form of the Common Interest Law or the Uniform Condominium Act in approximately half the states in the country. All 50 states in most countries have a condominium enabling or homeowner association, or as I say, common interest law. So what we've done, and I've given to you, and hopefully you'll pick up a copy of it, it's at the back of the room, is we've given you a chart. And this chart shows you, and you can follow it across, and we're not going to be doing this today, but you'll see in one column is the Condominium Act, and another column is the Cooperative Act, and another column is the HOA Act. And you can look across at different terms like proxies, quorums, voting, and you can see what the distinctions are in the acts. And this had never been done before in this fashion. And I did it originally for cluster housing, and we've updated it for you here today. What is the National Conference on Uniform State Laws? It's not a new concept, believe it or not. It was actually created in 1892. And back then, there was an idea, which time had come, that there should be uniformity in the laws across the country, so that if you travel between the states, perhaps your home state in Florida, there really shouldn't be that much differences. You should be able to understand how laws are applied across the country. The Commission on Uniform Laws is funded by the states. And every state determines the number of commissioners that they have. Some of the smaller states may only have one or two, similar to the way we have representatives in Congress. Some of the larger states may have 20 commissioners. But the key thing is, when it comes time to vote at the assembly, every state has one vote. And when we meet as a national organization, they actually do meet in assembly. You would think you were observing a meeting of the Senate, or rather the Florida Legislature or the United States Congress. The commissioners sit by state. They have state flags. And when they're called upon, they're not called upon by John Doe or Mary Smith. The chair actually calls and says, "Will the commissioner for the state of Florida rise?" And they make their comments. And so this is really a lot of pomp and circumstance. It's very formal meetings, and it does perform, I think, a very important function. The interesting thing about the commission, which I learned when I, as you'll hear in a moment, had an opportunity to participate, is that the commissioners on uniform laws entered into an agreement with the American Bar Association back in 1892. What they didn't want happening was to have two separate national bodies competing to see who could come up with the most or the most different uniform laws. So the ABA and the commission agreed, again, these are done by, you know, these federal acts. They agreed that the ABA would not participate. The ABA, again, is the American Bar Association. And they agreed that the American Bar Association would not draft legislation. Quite frankly, I didn't even know that until I got involved here. But then in exchange for that, the American Bar Association would have a right to have an advisor sit on every committee of the National Conference of Commissioners that was drafting legislation. At the time that the commission was assembling its committee for the purposes of amending the Uniform Common Ownership Housing Law, I was sitting as the chair of what they call the, I think it was the H Group of the American Bar Association, which was a group that oversaw laws dealing with common ownership housing, among others, timeshare resorts. And they asked if I would serve as their advisor to this committee. And we, for the next 3 years, we met 2-3 times a year in very exhaustive sessions that would begin on a Thursday evening, all day Friday, all day Saturday, usually into late on Sunday. And it would be a debate among experts in the field. One of the criteria of being a member of the commission, the only criteria, is you have to be an attorney. You have to be a member of the bar. But I have to tell you, I was very impressed when I went to my first meeting and realized that sitting in the room with me, again, I'm there as the advisor for the American Bar Association, were two sitting federal judges, at least 4 courts of appeals judges, and leaders of the industry. And then in addition to the actual participants, they have what they call I don't remember the exact term, it's people who has an interest in the field. So, for example, the Community Associations Institute has a representative there. The various housing organizations from across the country at the federal and state level have a representative there. And it's done in a very democratic process. That's what the I don't remember, small d, I guess, as they say. It's the process, not the party. In the sense that the chair, even though the only ones that have a legal right to vote on issues are the actual state commissioners, they allow all the people who are there to express their opinions, to freely interact in the discussions and the debate. And we would often sit in a meeting that would run 8-9 hours arguing over little words, one or two words. One of the things that we're going to be talking about, when I just briefly mention some of the things that this Uniform Act does, is one of the issues that I took exception to, and I know there are some here that will differ with me on this, is that one of the advocacy groups, which happens to be, and we're going to focus heavily on that today, another handout you should have, it's going to be very important for our discussion here, is the American Retired Persons, ARP. What are the acronym? The American Association of Retired Persons? Right. So make sure you have that in your hands, because we're going to need to be going over that. One of the things that ARP advocates is that associations shouldn't be allowed to lean, and that's in the back of the room. Make sure you have it, because we're going to spend a considerable amount of time on that. One of the things that ARP advocates is that associations not be allowed to lean in foreclosed units in condominiums until the amount owed reaches a minimum threshold. And as you're going to hear, I argued against their threshold because in shared ownership, if you have a large number of owners who are not paying their assessments, that translates to mean that assessment-paying owners need to pick up the difference. There's no free ride in share ownership. So I didn't agree with every position they took, but we spent at least an entire day debating that one issue, just to give you an idea how intense this process is. So why was the, and example, I want to give you a couple examples of some of the uniform laws. Any of you who are attorneys in business might have heard of the Uniform Commercial Code. That's been adopted by all 50 states, and that is one of the bills drafted by the commissioners on uniform laws. The Uniform Probate Code, the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, the Uniform Limited Partnership Act, the Uniform Interest Family Support Act, the Uniform Condominium Act, and the Uniform Common Ownership Interest Act are just a sample of probably over 100 different laws that have been drafted by the commissioners on uniform laws. Now, another thing about the uniformity in laws is the commission, let me pick up my glasses here. The commission doesn't have the authority to impose these laws on any states. What happens is they write the laws and they put them on the shelves, and then it's up to the state legislatures to decide whether or not they want to adopt that law for their states. So as the example I gave earlier, the Uniform Commercial Code had to go through the legislative process, it had to be introduced, and it had to be passed in the 50 states where it is now the law. Well, why is it that it came about that the commission was asked to amend the Uniform Act, which was already in existence, already adopted by, as I said, collectively between the Uniform Condo Act and the Uniform HO Act by about half the states. It's because the American Association of Retired Persons was advocating what is known as the Homeowner Bill of Rights. Here you have an organization that you and I both think of in dealing in areas of senior concern, and here they are basically as the primary advocacy group for our Homeowner Bill of Rights. And you might ask, why is that? Well, it's sort of startling to me, not that they're doing it, is what happened in the field of shared ownership. Think about this. The condominium concept traces its roots back to ancient Rome. It's mentioned in the codes of Babylonia. But it's the modern concept didn't really come into this country until around the mid-1960s. If I went across the landscape of this country around 1970, 1975, it would have been difficult to find 5,000 associations in this country governing shared ownership communities. Today, as we sit in this room, there are 300,000 associations governing over 24.5 million families. That's 60 million individuals. Shared ownership, mandatory membership associations today spend over $41 billion a year and have over $35 billion sitting in reserves. One in every five Americans now live in communities governed by mandatory membership associations. So it's probably not so unusual, if you think about it from that standpoint, that ARC is involved. They've heard the stories of abuses over reaching boards, owners who feel that their rights and interests are not being addressed, and they came up with a idea to have a uniform law. So what I thought I would do before I tell you some of the things we actually... So the ARC Bill of Rights is the catalyst. That is why we were meeting. ARC came to the Commission on Uniform Laws and said, we would like to see you infuse into the existing common ownership housing law these 10 provisions. And so what I'd like to do is for us to go over those 10 provisions, and I'm going to express my opinions, and later on you're welcome to also, you don't have to agree with me. Obviously there are others who disagree, or they would not have drafted this and be promoting it in every state. ARC, I understand, is going to be here at one of your future meetings. I don't know if they'll be speaking about the Bill of Rights, but when they come, tell them that we had a whole session on this. So let's look at these one at a time. And this is why, again, we convened, why we were gathering. And number one on the list is the right to security against foreclosure. And again, this isn't my words. This is in the ARP Homeowners Bill of Rights. So first I'm going to read what they are trying to pass, and I'm going to then express some comments on it. An association shall not foreclose against a homeowner except for significant unpaid assessments. Any such foreclosure shall require judicial review to ensure fairness. The last sentence, a lot of states have adopted what is called non-judicial foreclosure. We don't have that in Florida. Florida is a state where you have to get notice, you have an opportunity for hearing, it goes through the circuit court, and so that's really not applicable here, and I don't see anytime soon a non-judicial foreclosure process. But let's question this first one about non-foreclosure until the amount owed becomes significant. The lifeblood of a shared ownership community is the assessment. We don't have the fortune to have at our disposal what the President of the United States has, which is a printing press. Someone said an airplane. When we don't have enough money in the till of our associations to meet our obligations, we either discontinue those services or we run in arrears. Now, I've been in this business over 37 years, and I've never seen time or conditions as they exist today, not only in the nation. Some of you may have, you know, been around or heard or come out or been born after the Depression, but I've never seen a situation like this. And in the last 2 weeks, two associations in South Florida filed for bankruptcy. Associations. I didn't even know an association could utilize the benefit of the bankruptcy laws, because my thought always, if you have the ability to levy assessments, these aren't developers I'm talking about. These are the operating associations. They have so much debt and so few owners paying assessments. I don't know what the story is up here on Space Coast. But we have communities in South Florida and other parts of the state where as high as 30 to 40% of the units are not paying their assessments. And we all know that when lenders foreclose, even if they get a judgment on the monies that are owed, they do not take title to the condo units or the homeowner lot units until they have a buyer. Why not? Self-evident. The moment they take title, they step into the shoes of a unit owner. They don't care about the fact they have to pay 6 months assessment or 1 year in some cases in a homeowner association. They know that the minute that deed is vested in their bank's name, if there's a capital improvement, a special assessment, there's a casualty that blows through, a hurricane, and then there's underinsurance, they're going to be liable for assessments the same as all other unit owners. So they don't take titles. We have unit owners who are living in units who no longer pay assessments, no longer pay their mortgages. In some cases, they're renting out the units, and the rent's going in their pockets, not to pay any of their obligations. We just had a trial court in South Miami-Dade do something which we're all looking at as a potential vehicle to use, where he appointed a receiver and instructed the receiver to confiscate the rents being collected by these owners that are not paying their assessments. I think it's a good move. We're going to try and see if that might be utilized. Two utility companies have cut off the electricity and the water to two condominiums in South Florida. They've cut out security. They've cut out lawn maintenance. And to add insult to injury, we have the National Lending Organizations, the FHA, has just passed a regulation saying we will not approve loans in communities where the delinquencies exceed 15%. First of all, our Congress, our federal government created the problem by reducing lending requirements that allowed individuals who were not otherwise qualified to come in and buy into the shared ownership communities, 100% loans, no visible means of income. It was self-evident that the problem was going to occur. And when we used to ask the question, how are you intending to pay your assessments? The frequent response was, you don't have a right to ask, we qualified for a mortgage. And then shortly thereafter, when the assessments started rolling in, special assessment and casualties, of course, we all know the story thereafter. So you have an individual who comes into a community where the owner is delinquent. They're not paying their assessment. They're not paying their mortgage. They are qualified to buy. They show you a financial statement that shows they're going to be able to meet the assessment. And you have a federal agency saying, well, you got 15% of the owners in your community are delinquent, so we're not going to approve any loans in your community. You know, I think that's horrendous. I wrote a letter recently to the President of the United States. I didn't get a response. I'll tell you what the letter was about. The U.S. government, which translates means you and I, because the government doesn't have money of its own. It all its revenues come from taxes and from borrowing. And they approved, as we all know, TARP funds and other monies to bail out the nation's banks. And then they approved another law to allow the lenders to restructure the obligations of individuals who are upside down on the mortgages or underwater, whatever you want to call it. And my letter said, listen, we have 60 million people, 24 million families that are living in shared ownership communities, performing functions of government, a significant number who are not paying their assessments. I don't have a problem with your assisting the banks or helping individuals or your upside down the mortgages, but you should condition loaning to the banks and loaning to the individuals and restructuring their mortgages on them bringing their assessments owed to their associations current. Because the victims of the non-payment are innocent individuals who are timely paying their assessments and now being asked to also pay the assessments. for those who aren't paying. By only a few votes last month, the United States Senate turned down what is called the mortgage cram down law. Did you hear about that law? Another law being promoted by the administration. This is not anti-administration. This is what's going on in Washington right now. The cram down bill was a law designed to allow the bankruptcy court to restructure the mortgages that individuals have outstanding to bring them within a framework of their income stream. No issue there. But you know what else was in this bill? The bankruptcy court had a right to extinguish the obligations of the individual owed to their associations. Again, where's the disconnect here? If you tell all these people who are in foreclosure, you don't have to pay your assessments, who do you think is going to pay it? Again, this is just, I'm not making this up. One of our United States senators from Florida voted for that legislation. It's not aware that about 30% of the people in the state live in communities governed by mandatory membership associations or are going through this economic stress. So I, sitting at the Commission on Uniform Acts, with ARP representatives there, and individuals advocating for this threshold for foreclosure. They were arguing you cannot lien or foreclose an individual until they're at least a year late paying their assessments. Now, mind you, the way the court systems work, if you cannot even lien for a year after delinquencies, you have to give service a process. You have to get a court hearing day. That means that individual will probably be at least 2 years delinquent before you even get an opportunity to go to court. And the system is so backed up at the moment that the courts are giving you a total of like 30 seconds on foreclosures now. Once you get a hearing, 9 months to a year down the road. So I don't agree with this provision. Nevertheless, the Commission on Uniform Laws, I was able to get them to reduce it. And the Uniform Law says you cannot act until they're 3 months delinquent. We've advocated against them and successful so far in Florida of keeping this language out of our Condominium and Homeowner Association Acts. It was introduced by a couple of representatives, including Representative Robano, who had a provision in there that said, right out of the ARP bill. In fact, I told someone, I said, you know, when I became involved in the commission's work, I said, I never knew where all this legislation was coming from that was being introduced in Florida. I said, and I wrote an email to somebody, I said, I think I discovered the Holy Grail. I said, I found the ARP bill that had these 10 provisions in it, and they are reflective exactly of the legislative language that was being introduced in the Florida legislature. So Florida, we haven't adopted this. It is now in the Uniform Act 3 months. But ARP continues to advocate nationally that they want owners to be able to go at least a year in their delinquencies before they're collected against. Second, the ARP is advocating the right to resolve disputes without litigation. Homeowners and associations will have available alternative dispute resolutions through both parties to preserve the right to litigate. I have absolutely no problem with this. In Florida, we have alternative dispute methods. We have mediation. We have arbitration. In condominium, we have mandatory non-binding arbitration. Now, you say, is that an oxymoron? What does it mean, mandatory non-binding arbitration? Well, there is a reason that the bills read that way. It's because in the Constitution of the state of Florida and most states, it says that every citizen has a right of access to the courts. So you cannot have a law that says you cannot go into the court. But you can have, which is what the law says, a requirement that before you go into the courts, you have to try to resolve your dispute. And an alternative means in Florida is through this non-binding arbitration in a condominium setting. And in HOA, it's in mediation. There is a bill that's been introduced in each of the past sessions which did not pass. I'm supportive of it. It's called the Home Court Advantage Bill. And I think it's Senator Sembler or Representative Sembler, and it basically sets up a mechanism to have all these shared ownership disputes resolved through mandatory mediation, or at least presented for mandatory mediation before they go into courts. So I don't have a problem with number two. I think we should all work together to try to resolve disputes outside the court. As long as we preserve the right, then in the event we're not able to do so, that we can file litigation. Number three on the list is the right to fairness in litigation. Where there's litigation between an association and a homeowner, and the homeowner prevails, the association shall pay attorney fees to a reasonable level. Well, not only do I not disagree with that, it's part of our law. If you're in a condominium in this state and your association brings a lawsuit against you for an action that you're taking and the association loses, you have a right to recover your legal fees. So I think that's fair. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it. It's not in the HOA Act. That's one of the reasons why I'm talking about uniformity. It doesn't make sense. Why do we have a provision in the Condominium Act that says you can only serve a single term as a member of the board, 1 year unless your documents allow for staggered terms and by amendment, and then only for 2 years, yet if you're in a homeowner association, you can be elected to staggered terms as long as you want to go forward. No uniformity. Here's a good example of that. Condominium owners, they prevail, they get their legal fees. Homeowner and an HOA, you prevail, you do not get your legal fees. Good example where you need uniformity. Number four is the right to be told of all rules and charges. Homeowners shall be told before buying of the association's board's power, and the association may not exercise any power not clearly disclosed to the homeowner if the power unnecessarily interferes with the homeownership. Good suggestion. I'm for full disclosure. I wrote most of the provisions of the Condominium Act that require full disclosure. When I started practicing in this field 37 years ago, the entirety of the Condominium Act was probably 10 pages in length. Owners did not have a right to take over control of their associations. It was perpetually kept by the developers under 99-year management contracts and long-term recreational leases. It was purely what we call an enabling statute. Recognize the right to have the conveyance of air rights. The sole reason for having a Condominium Act is to convey air rights. Historically in the law, an individual is deemed to own not only their property, but all the mineral rights below their property and air rights above it up to certain limits. They couldn't put up a pole high enough to keep airplanes from flying over it. But you were deemed to own the air rights over your property. So in law that evolved over hundreds and hundreds of years and errors from the English law and the, of course, Louisiana from the French, there was no right for someone to come along and build a house over my house. And so they came up with this idea of condominium ownership, which is air right conveyance. So that was the reason that's where the laws actually came about, the Enabling Act, starting in the early 60s and through the 70s.
And that sentence there, is it the association's board power? Is that board or board?
It should be board powers. Thank you. I have to tell my assistant of that. Spell check only works so far. You've done that a million times. That's the problem with spell check. I've always said, what good is it if you can't spell it? I can't spell. So, you know, it looks like you hit the button, it comes up with a word, and you don't bother reading, and the next thing you wrote, I guess maybe, I don't think Arp was talking about broad powers. It was the board powers. Thank you. Number five. The right to stability in rules and change or charges. Homeowners shall have a right to vote to create, amend, or terminate deed restrictions and other important documents. Where an association director has power to change operating rules, the homeowners shall have notice and an opportunity by a majority vote to override new rules and charges. no problems. The rights of the people is paramount. That's true in our society. It's true in our communities, associations. The ultimate rights and decisions are vested in the owners. And if the owners don't like the rules, the covenants, they should have a right to be able to change those. I have absolutely no problem or objection to that. Number six is the right to individual autonomy. This one I question slightly. Homeowners shall not surrender any essential rights of individual autonomy because they live in a common interest community. Homeowners shall have the right to peaceful advocacy during elections and other votes, as well as the use of the common areas. No problem with the last sentence. Let's talk about autonomy. The single most quoted statement that was ever in a case law in Florida, and the only quote from law I put in my new book. The book has no case sites, it has no case law, it's written conversationally, with one exception. It's the thread that runs throughout common interest ownership. And didn't come from a condo case, it actually dates back hundreds of years. But it's quoted in the Sterling Village case in Florida, and it's been re-quoted in probably 100 decisions since then. And it goes something like this, slightly paraphrased. Every man may consider his home his castle, and he the king thereof. And nevertheless, the sovereign fiat to use his property as his pleases must yield when the ownership is in common and cooperation with others. How can you have total autonomy when you've agreed as a condition of living in a shared ownership community to certain covenants, conditions, and restrictions that say that the good of the community, so long as it's not designed to abridge your fundamental rights, will be paramount? You know, I have a whole chapter in the book about nuisance, smells, dogs barking. I have one case that starts the book, a true case of a unit owner who would land his helicopter at the end of the day on the roof of a condominium. And needless to say, the individual who lived on the penthouse floor was a little annoyed by it. This is true. It's an appellate decision. It starts off the book. Here's this guy sitting down to dinner every night, and then suddenly he hears twat, 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 the sounds of a helicopter rotor blade going around over his roof. The individual, is Knabby Carver, and I don't remember which was the guy in the helicopter and which was the unit owner. But ultimately, the case went into the courts, and the court ruled that the guy was creating a nuisance and enjoined it. Well, you know, it's a true story. I the author, you can't make this stuff up. I have a single family detached home that's my primary residence, but I too have a beach condominium that I like going down to, and I go down with my family, my grandchildren. I have a 5-year-old grandson. I'm not quite 5, but almost 5. Just correctly, no, named Jordan. And here's a guy who's not even 5 years old, and we're walking down the hall to my unit, and he says, Papa, he says, and he made up the name he calls me. I'm sure you have grandchildren, and they make up their own names. And once they say it, they can call you whatever they want as long as they recognize your existence, right? And the funny part is my 18-month-old, who says Papa, but he thinks my wife and I are both Papa. We come as a package. Jordan's walking down the hall, and he says, Papa, he says, what's that that stinks? And I said, someone is cooking in their unit. He says, well, I don't like that smell. And I says, you know, I says, it's funny you said that. Of course, I'm talking to a 5-year-old. And I said, because I wrote about that in my new book. And it's part of living in closed compounds. You know, you hear the sounds of the dog's paws scratching across the floor. Dogs don't communicate as we do on telephones and text messaging. They bark. And it's just the way it is. And if you're living in a common ownership housing community and close compounds, there are many advantages. Far more advantages than disadvantages. But one of the disadvantages is you do have to give up certain rights that you'd have in a single-family detached home in the middle of the wilderness. So I don't understand what Art means by this, having they can't abridge their autonomy. A core condition of shared ownership is you give up certain rights that you would otherwise have in single-family detached home ownership. Number 7, I totally agree with. The owner should have the right to oversight of associations and directors. Homeowners shall have reasonable access to records and meetings, as well as specified abilities to call special meetings, obtain oversight of elections and other votes, and to recall directors. Totally agree. And we have that in all of our laws in Florida. With or without cause, you don't like the job the board's doing, vote them out. With or without cause, sign a petition, majority of the owners, and put people in who are more responsive to your needs. Probably, if you read the column, you see that a significant number of people write in and say the board is overreaching, they think they're little dictators, they're not respecting the rights of the interests of the owners. And I always write back the same thing. I said, but you have the ultimate authority. They only sit on that board because you've elected them, or perhaps they've been appointed, but it doesn't matter. You can remove them. If they're not responsive, vote them out. Don't reelect it. I personally am against the concept of term limits for a simple reason. Every time, I'm not talking just in boards and government generally, because every election is a term limit decision. If you don't like the job your elected officials are doing, vote them out of office. And obviously, if they're doing something that's illegal, they should be arrested, they should be put in jail, and they should pay retribution. I don't support any type of misappropriation of funds or mismanagement of books or denying owners the access to the books. Though the strangest of all the cases I dealt with in the years was a president of an association who took the association monies and went to Europe and had a sex change operation. Number 8. The right to vote and run for office. Homeowners shall have well-defined voting rights, including secret ballots, and no director shall have a conflict of interest. You may love it, you may hate it, but I think the method by which we elect our directors and condominiums work. It's effective. It's a ballot within a ballot. It ensures the right of people to vote without proxies. And I'm not saying that just because I wrote it. And I did. I used to show up at meetings of associations. And again, this is the truth. And I'd walk into a room of a community that would have 100, 200 units, and be 5 people in the room. And sitting in front of one of the people would be stacks of papers, which were proxies. And I didn't think that was fair. So I served as a member of the state of Florida commission that traveled around the state dealing with trying to reform the laws. And when we met, we developed this idea of having the right of individuals to qualify for the board without nomination, to have their names listed without distinction of whether they were an incumbent or otherwise, and have all owners the right to vote and preclude individuals from being able to cast the votes of other owners and to vote by proxy. I think that process should be adopted into the Homeowner Association Act. It only exists in the Condominium Act, and I believe in the Cooperative Act at the current. But it works. And there's a process for allowing you to have the ombudsman office even come in and to supervise at a cause the election to make sure it's fair and reasonable. One problem. You'll see the last thing done is, so I'm going to jump ahead, is advocates for an ombudsman. We have an ombudsman in Florida. What do you think the legislature did this year? No, they didn't eliminate the ombudsman. They just took away the money. Same thing. You know, it really is horrendous if you really knew the truth that somehow is not reported in the papers of how government really functions and how they sweep the trust funds. You know those monies that you collect, that you pay every year if you're a condominium owner to go in to fund education and enforcement for the division? That doesn't go to the division. It goes into trust monies. And the state, when they need money, just sweeps these trust monies clean and use them into part of the operating revenues. I personally am embarrassed as a resident of the state of Florida to know that we rank number 50 in the nation in funding of education. 50 in the nation in funding of education. I think something is terribly wrong when the source of funding is playing a lotto. I mean, the whole future of this country and this of our futures are tied up in the education of our youth. And I'm horrified by the cutbacks in education and teaching, and to realize that that's how little money this state puts into education in the states. This state that we have to rely upon people gambling. And they really are gambling, because they're gambling with our futures for that. But that's a different story. So, no problem here with that one. Number 8 is the right to vote and run for office. Homeowners shall have a well-defined voting rights, including secret ballots, and no director shall have a conflict of interest. Agree with that, totally. Under the law, as we passed last year, if a director has a vested financial interest in any of the vendors in which they're contracting for, that has to be fully disclosed. And the owners have a right post-contract to vote to change the contract. I'm fully supportive of that. There are management companies that have interconnecting relationships with their vendors and contractors. That now has to be disclosed. I fully support that. I think you should know if someone has a interest in any business which is doing business with the association. No problem with that. Now, the next one, the right to reasonable association directors. Association directors and other agents shall act reasonably in exercising their powers over the association. Who could disagree with that? A director is a fiduciary. They're in a position of trust. They're required to act in the best interest of the owners. Well, the question asked is, what if they don't understand the word reasonableness? Well, again, vote them out. But those are the 10 provisions that precipitated. The last one's the ombudsman. I already talked about that. That's why I spent 3 years traveling across the country, sitting down in meetings with commissioners on uniform laws. And that act now, the amended act, is now broken into two parts. There's a freestanding homeowner's bill of rights, which is available if states want to consider it. It does not parallel exactly the ARP request, because the commissioners did not agree, as I didn't agree, with all of their provisions. But some of these provisions now have been adopted into and amended into the Common Interest Ownership Act, and it's now up to the states that have previously adopted that act as to whether or not they wish to adopt it. I do want to mention to you, and by the way, Harry, or what is my time so I know? How long does your meeting go, just so I can just have a second? Tell what? Okay, so we still have time. I'm going to cover a couple of areas and I'm going to answer your questions. There are two things that we did put into the Common Interest Ownership Act that I think are good, that we should adopt into our acts here in Florida. Do you know how it is that sometimes you have some really petty, inconsequential violation of rules or covenants, that the board says, well, we have no option, we need to go ahead and take enforcement action, because if we don't take enforcement action, we're waiving our rights to do so on similar or the same type of violations. Maybe there are extenuating circumstances. Maybe it's a one-time occurrence. But the way the law has evolved, the courts have said selective enforcement, estoppel, and we talk about that in the book. If you don't act, you don't act decisively, then you waive your right to be able to do so. There's a great provision that I want to see put into the Florida Act that we wrote into the Uniform Act. And what it says, and I'm going to just look down here for a second because the language, it's not in your document. The executive board may determine whether to take enforcement action by exercising the association's power to impose sanctions or commence an action for violation of the declaration, bylaws, and rules, including whether to compromise any claim for unpaid assessment or other claims made by or against it. Here's the key words. The executive board does not have a duty to take enforcement action. If it determines that under the facts and circumstances presented, the association legal position does not justify taking any or further enforcement action, the covenant restriction or rule being enforced is or likely to be construed as inconsistent with the law, although a violation may exist or may have occurred, it is not material as to be objectionable to a reasonable person or to justify expending the association's resources, it is not in the association's best interest to pursue an enforcement action. Do you agree? I think there should be discretion there. I think it's horrendous every time I see associations taking legal action, hiring lawyers, to file suit against owners for matters which, as a general rule, the community really doesn't care about, strictly because they have been led to believe by the courts and by lawyers that if they don't do so, that they're sometimes compromising their ability to take actions in the future. Another provision that we've added in the law is this: the Uniform Act, that I think should be in the Florida laws, is the executive board shall establish a reasonable method for unit owners to communicate among themselves and with the executive board on matters concerning the association. There should be a means by which owners can communicate to their board members, and obviously we have the tools today to allow us to do so with the use of the internet. And even without the internet, there should be a vehicle within the community, be it newsletters or other devices, to ensure that every owner has access to the board and be able to express their views and their concerns and their criticism. Now, one of the things we have done, and I mentioned to you, is that the directors are fiduciaries of the owners in position of trust. The officers and directors are entitled to act as they reasonably believe is proper in exercising a business judgment. And the courts have held, as long as the director of a corporation decides matters rationally, honestly, and without disabling conflict of interest, the decisions will not be reviewed by the courts. And what that translates basically to mean, if you volunteer, we cannot go so far with this pendulum that people refuse or are unwilling to serve on the boards, because volunteerism is essential for shared ownership. And if everybody that serves on the board needs to constantly be in fear that they're going to be sued for their business decisions, then they're not going to be individuals who are willing to serve. And so what the courts have historically done is cloaked into the volunteers with immunity, so long as they don't act in a manner that is self-serving. They're not accepting money or misfeasance or malfeasance, which basically translates that they're committing criminal acts. And I don't have a problem with that. I tell you what I do have a problem with and think it's absurd. And I know he's a good guy. I've met with him. I like him individually, but it doesn't mean I always have to agree with his policies. And I know I think he probably has spoken here a number of times. is I don't agree with this provision that was put into the Condominium Act last year that would have been removed this year, except for the fact that the governor, there's a bill, Senate Bill 880, didn't get its hearing in the Senate floor, and I'll tell you why in a second. And that is a provision that says everyone who qualifies to run for the board of a condominium has to certify that they have read the Condominium Act, they've read the administrative rules, and they've read the condominium documents, and they understand them to the best of their ability. Now, my friends, I'm an adjunct law professor. I've taught condominium law and practice for over 30 years at Nova Southeastern University. In fact, this past 2008, I was recognized as the adjunct law professor of the year for teaching of doctrinal studies. I teach a class that runs 37 weeks, 3 hours a week. At the end of the semester, I give an exam to law students. Less than half of my class get half right. And we have a law in this state that says that if you want to run for the board of a condominium, you have to certify that you understand all the provisions of the Condominium Act, 90% of which have absolutely nothing to do with the operation of the association. I'll come back to your question in a second. Yeah, I will. Take a minute and scan through the Condominium Act. If you serve on the board, you're supposed to have read it. Just scan through it. There's entire sections that tell you how to calculate converter reserves. Those are provisions for people who are converting rental buildings to condominium, how you have to calculate the reserves for roof and repainting and paving and whatnot. What the heck does that have to do with you making decisions as a member of a board? There's whole sections on disclosure, what you have to disclose to prospective buyers. There's whole sections on the operation of the division. You can take down the entirety of the act that's this thick, and you can take two sections that deal with operation. Fine, if you want people to read that, fine. So there was a provision that we wrote into Senate Bill 880 this year. It was a very important piece of legislation that never was voted on the last day of the session. Why? Because three state representatives were so obstinate in their desire to impose amendments that were inconsequential and of no benefit that they refused to withdraw their amendments so this bill could pass. Among the provisions of Senate Bill 880, which I believe was supported by the Space Coast Association, is a great piece of legislation. Among the things in that bill, it would have required lenders to pay their assessments for more frequently and in larger amounts. It would have amended this provision out of the act to say that if you qualify, if you run for the board and get elected, you have to read the documents. But you weren't going to be tested as a lawyer. It had another provision that I wrote with the development bar. It made a major concession here, but I thought it was more critical. It was called the Distressed Property Relief Act of 2009. It would have allowed what we call vulture funds to go in and sweep up and take title to all of these foreclosed units and unsold units in failed projects. And to the extent that they didn't physically build them, they wouldn't have warranty responsibilities. So why would I say, great, fine, you won't have warranty responsibilities? Because in exchange for that, I wrote into this law that they had to pay the assessments owed to the associations, not only currently, past, present, and in the future. It would immediately infuse the money into the associations to keep them from filing bankruptcy. And with all the important things the legislature did this year, they couldn't even find 5 minutes in the last week of the session to bring Senate Bill 880 up on the floor and be voted on. But I think even worse than that was the governor vetoing Senate Bill 714. And I've expressed that. I've expressed this to the governor. Now, I'm going to tell you something in this room that's bad. The governor vetoed that bill because he was lobbied to veto it by the former fire marshal of this state. That's how bills are made and laws occur. why would the fire marshal veto the bill? There was a provision in the bill that delayed. It didn't take away the obligation of condominiums that are 75 feet or higher, to retrofit for fire sprinklers in their common areas and hardwire fire alarm systems. I've already told you the story. I got condominiums all over the state that are going towards bankruptcy. Owners being stressed out with not being able to pay their assessments. And you have a law that says by 2014 you have to retrofit these buildings at a cost, I guesstimate, is going to be anywhere from $200,000 to $400,000. Who's going to pay for it? That's why Senate Bill 714 was vetoed. Because the fire marshals were lobbying, the former fire marshal of the state was lobbying for the pipe fitters. They're the ones that would retrofit these buildings. Now, why am I so angered by the veto? Because there were some very good provisions in Senate Bill 714 that also went down the drain. In drafting the amendments in 2008, in an artfully written law, think about this one. I'll tell you what it says in the statute today. Whoever wrote this, you know, unfortunately you have people writing these laws who sometimes really don't understand the law and the concept. If you live in a condominium and you have a balcony, there's a limited common elements attached to the building. I'm not talking about the surface. I'm not talking about the finish. But you have the balcony. You have exclusive use, but it's part of the building structure. A hurricane blows through here this year. Your building is significantly destroyed, including damage to that balcony. Under the law that's on the book of Florida today, passed last year, you're responsible to rebuild that balcony. Not the building collectively as a common expense of restoring the structure, the individual who has exclusive use of that. If you have a storage room, you have a parking space. You see, what the law says is passed last year, that any of the improvements for which unit owners have the exclusive use to the limitation of other owners, those unit owners are responsible to insure it and to repair it in the event of a casualty. I don't think that's the way it's supposed to be. Personally, I'm for the idea that we go back to what used to be, which is called the bare wall concept, where the association buys an insurance policy on the building that's built by the developer, and all the unit owners are responsible for is the personalty and the upgrades. And by the way, that was what the intent of the person who submitted that was, to require the individual to be responsible for betterments and upgrades. But they wrote for the improvements. That's a term of legal art. Senate Bill 714 also, as I said, I was thinking it was Senate Bill 880, but it wasn't Senate Bill 714. Also said that you eliminated this requirement that you get a law degree in order to serve on the board. It also did something else. Right now, and I'm opposed to this, and some people say, why? It's a good thing. I'm opposed to it. Currently, a homeowner has responsibility to insure certain defined components that are excluded from the association's policy. Wall coverings, ceiling coverings, fixtures, appliances. Do you remember it used to be in there where the unit owners are responsible for covering their unit air conditioning? Last year, they took that out, and that's now under the association. That policy, associations are responsible for that. But what the law currently, as we sit in this room, says is if you don't furnish evidence, if you're a unit owner, of having insurance on those defined components, the association can force place coverage on your unit, charge you for the coverage, and assess it in lien and foreclose your home for not carrying it. I don't think that's the business association should be in. Again, I think the law should be rewritten in a different fashion. So I wasn't very happy with what the Florida legislature did this year. And I want you to know that. Two other things, I'll take your questions. Center for Disease Control, you may have read this in my column, has issued a warning. Now, before I tell you what the warning is, let me flash back. You have the Fair Housing Amendments Act of 1988. That act says that you cannot discriminate in housing against families with children unless you qualify as housing for older persons, which is an exemption under law. That's the 55 years of age or over exemption. HUD goes down to a condominium in South Florida that has a rule saying no diapers allowed in the swimming pool. No matter whether it's a child or an adult, no diapers. And under testimony from someone who I don't know degree of qualification, HUD determines that an association rule that has that is a violation of the housing provision that says discrimination against families with children. Well, less than 2 months ago, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta issued a warning saying that swim diapers do not keep fecal materials from flowing into swimming pools. Last year around the country, there were thousands of incidents of illnesses caused by fecal materials in swimming pools. So, in my column, I wrote about this. This is the Center for Disease Control alert. It says little scientific information exists on how well they're able to keep feces or infection-causing germs from leaking into the pool. Even though diapers or swim pants may hold in some feces, they are not leak-proof and can contaminate the pool water. It is unlikely that swim diapers are able to keep diarrheal stools, the high-risk event, from leaking in the pool, and no manufacturers claim these products prevent leakage of diarrhea into pools. Be aware that swim diapers and swim pants are not a solution for a child with diarrhea or a substitute for frequent diaper changing. It is recommended you change your child often, et cetera, et cetera. So here we have the Center for Disease Control issuing an alert that contradicts the HUD ruling that says you have to allow diapers in your swimming pool. I'm not here. I have grandchildren. You know, I don't take them into pools in diapers, because I'm concerned about the other people who are in those pools. At least be aware of it. I'm bringing it to your attention. A decision out of the Florida Northern District. Last comment. I wrote an article that was widely disseminated, appeared in a newspaper, in a magazine called Common Ground. It's called Prescription Pets. It deals with the wave of letters associations are receiving from doctors that try to circumvent no pet provisions of condominiums by saying that pet is required as an emotional support animal. I just spoke on this subject at a Florida housing conference. The audience was stacked with people who are advocates for pets in condominium. In fact, one of the people has a website, Pets in Condominium. Very nice people. But as I said to her, I said, you know, there are people who are given choices. They can choose to live in a community that allows families, or they can choose housing for older persons. And the federal law says that in those communities, if they qualify, then children below the age of 18 are not allowed to live there. There are people who move into no-pet buildings because they have allergies or fears of animals. And those fears, to me, are legitimate because I've seen their doctor's letter, as is the person who says that they want the comfort of being able to have their cat, their dog, or some other animals. If you go on the website, you'll see that among the animals now being promoted as meeting the qualifications for a trained service animal or miniature horses. And if you saw the news recently, there was one of the segments, they showed a woman shopping in a grocery store riding a miniature horse. So maybe a miniature horse will be soon coming into your community. And quite frankly, I don't have an issue with trained service animals for handicapped persons. Those are no-brainer. If you have a person who has visual or hearing impairment and they have an animal that's been trained for it and certified and the animal's not creating a nuisance, there's no debate on whether or not they should allow that animal. I want to read this to you. A thing I mentioned in one of my columns. Verbatim, not mine. This is from a president of an association. Our condo does not allow pets. Since becoming the board president, the gentleman has brought a parrot, which he brings outside of his patio early in the morning, and has awoken me several times before 8 a.m. He tells me that he needs a parrot as a service animal for his injured hand. He has lived here for about 3 to 4 years now and had a cockatiel, which makes a lovely sound. I never said a word, but this parrot is interfering with the peaceful enjoyment of my unit. It squawks so loudly that I have to turn my TV way up to be heard. I've asked him to please keep the bird inside so as not to disturb me, but he refused. Doesn't he need to show a doctor's letter in order to keep this bird? Second example. Again, I don't want to mention names. These are real letters. This is dated April 2nd, 2009. I get at least 5 of these a week. These aren't to my column. These are coming into associations I represent. Bernice has a cat. She is also suffering from dementia. The cat appears to have a calming effect on her and makes it much easier to live with the difficulties associated with knowledge that one has dementia. Giving up a cat would have a seriously deleterious effect on her mental and physical health. Now, I've asked a lot of trained doctors on whether or not a cat can, in fact, assist with dementia, and not one of them has told me that it can. But here's what a court in the Northern District of Florida ruled in March about these letters. And I won't bother you with the details of the case. It was a very interesting case involving an individual who bought a puppy into a condominium in which was a no-pet condominium and had signs posted everywhere saying no pets. He knew that at the time he purchased, and when he was asked during the court proceedings why he bought the dog, he said he didn't pay the signs any attention or documents. He just felt that he'd deal with it when it came time to deal with it. He even advocated for and tried to get the condominium to change its rules and regulations against pets. The other members, including the board, refused. A year after moving in, a year after, he then comes to the board with a certification that the dog was now a trained service animal. Had a letter from a doctor saying that he suffered childhood traumas associated with attacks or abuse. And therefore, he needed this animal to be able to address his mental condition. Goes before the federal court in the Northern District of Florida. In a lengthy decision, the court says, look, they repeat all the history of this case, including the individual's having the dog without ever saying he had a mental handicap. It was an untrained animal at the time he bought it. And the court said, in order for an association to be required to permit a emotional support animal, there's two things that it has a right to do. First, the individual with the handicap must express in detail. A lot of people ask me this question, do we have to tell what our handicap is? And the court says yes. You not only have to describe in detail the nature of your handicap, you have to express how the animal that you want to keep will ameliorate the conditions or the symptoms which you're trying to have treated. More importantly, the court said, that you can question the doctor as to his specialty training that allows him to diagnose the problem and prescribe the pet as being a means of ameliorating the symptoms of the illness. This is a very important decision for associations to, in response to this wave of letters that we're now receiving. First case decision on that point, although it follows a similar federal decision out of another jurisdiction. Okay, enough said. I thank you, and what we're going to do for the remainder of time is take your questions. Okay. Wow.
The category.
Enough to write a column?
Ten. Okay. I love this next question because... Thank you so much. This is actually covered in my book. Please outline for me the pros and cons of association's decision to self-manage. I have a whole section in my book about that. Let me tell you what I concluded, having experienced association operations. At the end of the section, I said, although there is an added cost associated with it, that I believe associations, larger associations, should hire professional management. And the reason I reached that conclusion, and I gave the three choices, I gave the choice of board self-management, hiring of a professional manager to act as a chief operating officer under the direction of the board, and an independent management company. So we cover all three. And the reason I reached that conclusion is that, honestly, I said that from my experience, most individuals who serve on boards and who live in these shared communities have never had the responsibility, nor do they have the knowledge, of managing property of the magnitude and costs that these communities are. These, in some cases, are hundreds of millions of dollars worth of property. And professional management, it does enhance the value of being able to not only hire the necessary individuals who have the skill levels in terms of the vendors to maintain the property, but they're an intermediary, a block between the board, which is a policy-making body, and the unit owners in terms of the day-to-day management and operation of the community. Now, there are some very small associations, 5, 10, 15, 25 units. I can understand that those communities want to try to manage themselves. I cannot imagine any community of size doing it. So that was my recommendation in the book. And I think if more details when you read the book, you'll understand the rationale for my decision. I also note that some of the larger management companies, through economy of scale, actually are able to deliver not only the, I'm not talking about the management fees, but the services such as pool maintenance, landscape maintenance, repaving, repainting. They have experience with vendors. They know which vendors are trustworthy, which ones perform the best job. They know from experience what the prices should be, and I've found that they're able to deliver better services. I also said what all of us know. I said, look, they're good and bad in every field. I've had managers who also have absconded with association monies. The fact that you hire management, either an individual or a company, doesn't mean you shouldn't do your due diligence. If you shouldn't do a background search, you shouldn't ask for references, you absolutely should. But again, in the book I say, self-management is the way to go. If the lender does not take title after foreclosure, where does the title reside? It's still in the unit owner. The fact that they get a judgment doesn't transfer title, and that's what the problem is. So the association, what I recommend some of our associations are doing is go ahead and foreclose on their lien. Take title, and during the period of time until the bank gets around to short selling or taking title, see if you can rent out the unit. And take the proceeds and use them towards paying down the assessments that are owed in the unit. In some cases, I've even gone as far as making a deal with the delinquent owners who are abandoning the units or default note. Just give us a quick claim deed to your unit and immediately take the title. The association in taking title is not liable for the mortgage. The fact that you take title doesn't mean you have an obligation for the mortgage. It means that you're just going to sit with the ownership with a superior lien, the mortgage, until such time as the bank gets around to foreclosing. But the title is vested in the unit owner. Our recall procedures for a cooperative community are the same as those for a condominium. The answer is yes. I believe those two statutes have parallel. I mentioned that earlier. What is the minimum amount that an association should invest in any buying $200,000 for 209? In your opinion, what is the degree of risk of the association fund exceed the FDIC insured amounts? I've answered this many times. I do not think associations should have monies deposited in banks these days that is not covered by FDIC insurance unless you have a separate agreement with the bank to pledge its assets as additional collateral for the money that's sitting there. Now, fortunately, we live in a time where banks that have been bailed out or failed have been taken over by other banks or by the U.S. government. And I don't know of anyone that has really lost deposits in banks, but it's not your money. If you're sitting on board, I recommend that you keep money dispersed in such a fashion that it's going to be safe and it's going to be insured. Again, there are devices that can be used with large banks where the bank will pledge this additional collateral, the coverage of any deposits that you may have with those banks. Interestingly enough, there's nothing in the statute or the uniform law that defines exactly how funds of the association should be invested. And regrettably, I know of associations that actually invested the reserve accounts into some of these money markets that lost during this recent economic downturn. What is the benefits of an association taking a member to small claims court in an effort to collect a debt not eligible for filing a lien? You can do it. I've had good success over the years. I don't do it much anymore just because I don't have the physical time. When I have and the area where we do that the most would be the failure to pay of a fine. Keep in mind you cannot foreclose a unit for non-payment of a fine because it's homestead property in most cases. Why is it that you can foreclose the property if you have a lien on it for non-payment assessment, even if it's homestead property? This is an exception to the homestead law. It's for the betterment of the property. So even if property is homesteaded, you can still lien and foreclose the property for non-payment of assessments, but not for non-payment of a lien. So what we do is we get discovery in aid of execution, which tells us whether the person has assets. Garnishment's really not in the state a good option. It's very difficult to garnish someone's wages in Florida, particularly if they're the head of a household. But amounts may sound a sleazy way to do it, but I've actually gone after individuals' pets, which are deemed to be personalty. And you can attach personalty in the state. And so I've actually, in discovery, found that a person has a little pet poodle, and we can say, well, we're going to attach the poodle unless you bring your assessments current. And you'd be surprised how quickly someone will pay for it to keep their favorite pet. How does an association get approval for FHA loans? The association doesn't get the approval. The individual gets the approval, but I've already told you 15% delinquency is not going to happen. They now require, I think it's debt to equity. I believe it's 80%, the highest loan that they'll approve. It used to be 100%. It's now 80%. What's the protocol for hearing committee when a fine has been noticed by the association? Due process of law, notice and hearing. Anyone accused of violating a covenant condition before a grievance committee, there has to be a notice to the individual. There has to be an opportunity for hearing. The grievance committee is a little slightly different than an HOA and a condominium. In a condominium, there's still some confusion on this. Grievance committee, in one case, can actually levy the fine. It's appealable to the board. In the other case, they recommend the fine, and it's then decided by the board. But regardless, once the fine is on the unit, as I said, the way to collect it, you have to go to small claims court, unless the amount is large enough. Generally, it's not because it's a cap at $1,000. $100 a day, $1,000 in the aggregate, although in an HOA setting, it seems that the fines can be for larger amounts. This question comes up a lot. We recently had a longtime renter die. After the funeral, the owner went in to clean the condo but found a man and a woman living there. They stated the keys fell out of his hand when he died. He also had the electricity transferred to his name and now has a right to live there. He has six-page record. The condo owner had started evicting proceeding. Is there any process to remove this family? This is a common problem. I mentioned that earlier. Do you remember? I think I talked about it here, didn't I? I mean, I give speeches, you know, frequently. I talk about this so often that I don't remember where I was speaking about it. It was here or elsewhere. You've heard of the same from the recent issue in the paper called Craigslist. There are a lot of these lists around. And these people who follow the bank foreclosures and liens, and they get the addresses of apartments that are empty or abandoned or in foreclosure. And they go over and they have a locksmith. They're in cahoots with locksmiths and they change the locks. And they list them on lists around the country for seasonal rentals or weekly rentals or vacation rentals. And they get the individuals who are renting, don't check, don't know these aren't the owners. And they actually come in and they pay cash to the individuals who are doing this. And most cases, no one knows that they're living there. These aren't frequently single-entry, high-rise, gated communities. These are large, sprawling communities, so often occupied by investor or seasonal owners. There's not as much detail. It's like a vacation resort like we have right here in Cocoa Beach in the Melbourne area. And this is a scam that's going on. We don't permit self-help in Florida, so you have to go and get judicial relief to be able to evict these individuals. However, on television in Channel 10 just this past week, they did a series on this, and I saw where the individual was able to get the sheriff's office to remove the individual because they had no valid claim to be there. They weren't the owner. And the sheriff actually, they called the police and said, there's someone living in our unit. We're the owners. They're not tenants. And the sheriff actually removed the individual without having to go through a court eviction. Some of you may know, in different parts of the world, including a number of the European countries, there are squatters' rights. And you're not allowed to remove someone who's squatting in your empty or abandoned units. You have to go through a very exhaustive process to be able to do that. I'm going to put this one off to the side. I might talk about that in my column. A lawsuit was filed against our association. The president was not informed. Two of the board members and the ex-management company knew about it. None of the association members were informed of a lawsuit. It's a very dangerous situation because if a lawsuit, now I don't know what happened here, if a lawsuit isn't responded to within a defined time, I think it's 20 days from service and maybe 30, I don't do the litigation anymore, then you get a default judgment. The law requires that the members be informed of litigation that's filed against the association so they can determine whether or not there's adequate insurance coverage of the association or whether they need to place their carriers on notice. What should be occurring here is that you have a resident agent for the association. And the resident agent we generally recommend is your lawyer. Because when a resident agent means that's the person who's going to be served with the process. So if an attorney is served process, they will inform the association to do one of two things, either to defend or turn it over to your insurance carrier for defense. And necessary to file a pleading in the court to preclude defaults from being entered. There's a significant number of associations that find out too late that defaults have been entered against them and when the judgment holders try to collect against the association. So the solution to this is the resident agent. The resident agent should not be the manager or the members of the board, but rather should be an attorney for your association. If that attorney then fails to inform you to take appropriate action, you would have a cause of action against that attorney for malpractice. Who knew about it and did nothing?
Yeah.
You know, well, you know, there's always a potential for breach of fiduciary. I don't know what the ultimate consequence was of their being served and not taking action. This question doesn't tell me that. So it depends upon whether the association was damaged as a result, what the nature of the litigation was, which also doesn't tell me here. The courts have been very liberal in immunizing directors to the extent that they didn't personally receive a benefit. In other words, that they didn't have a pecuniary gain personally as a result of not taking action. So the best thing to do is just to preclude it from happening by making sure that someone who is liable and responsible is receiving notice of the litigation that's filed against your association. 90% of the claims filed against associations are covered by insurance, either directors and officers liability or liability coverage for injury on the premises. Courts have held associations are liable for dog bites that take place on the common areas, even though obviously the association doesn't own the dog, because they say the party that has the right to control the property is responsible for incidents that take place on the property. That's why it's so important to have adequate insurance coverage and to make sure you cover all the, and by the way, we do talk about that too, risk and liability in new neighborhoods. To what extent is association responsible for hurricane preparedness? The law, and I don't know if it's changed, says you have to have a disaster plan in place. I've written extensively on this. It's available free of charge. I wrote disaster preparedness and response. The flyer or brochure, it's about 6 pages long, is available free of charge. If the Space Coast Community Associations, and I commend you, by the way, in changing to also include communities and not just condominiums because they're an integral part of shared ownership. If you would like a stack of these hurricane preparedness brochures, just email me. We'll send them to you. We also have a fire evacuation brochure. A lot of our associations have had fires over the year, and we put together a brochure for residents on what to do in the event of fires, how to evacuate a building, how to know how to go out of a building, particularly high rises, when there's smoke filling the hallways of those buildings. I'm just talking to the president of the association. We're going to send a stack of them here, and then they can disperse them to their members. In other words, it would be easier if I just sent you a stack and then with some of the notices of the future meetings, maybe you can mail these out to your members. Yes, go. Yes, sir. And I meant to call on you before you raised your hand earlier.
That was something else. But, regarding this item, if you go over to the Bryce County Emergency Center, they have all kinds of transfers.
Right. Yeah, I know that. Obviously, we're in the midst of the hurricane season. We're all going to hope that we're not hit again by the rash of storms we've had in the past. But the reality are we live in a hurricane-prone area. You should be prepared. My brochure talks about not only the critical nature of a plan, but also the two most important things to do following the hurricane. I'll tell you the three most important things to do. Number one on the list, do not, under any condition, sign those one-page agreements with restoration companies that say, sign us the insurance proceeds, and we'll go ahead and clean up, shore up, and repair your buildings. I should not tell you not to sign them because most of the litigation that we're handling post-hurricane isn't against insurance companies, although there are a lot of those for non-paying claims. They're against companies that perform inferior work and cleanup following a casualty. Now, there's some very good restoration companies, but it really depends upon the nature and extent of the contract. The only agreement you should sign immediately following a storm is an agreement for mitigation. Mitigation is two things. It's required by the law, or it can compromise your claim. And mitigation is shoring up. And that means immediately after the storm to close up the holes in the building, remove the drywall, the wet drywall that can cause mold, and secure the premises. And that's all part of also it's shoring up and drying out. If the association doesn't mitigate damages, it can compromise the claim. I also, see if time permits, because I want to tell you this story. It's very important. Whew, I'm not going to be able to get through all these questions, but I think this is more important. Let me mention this to you. There was a defense decision recently against an association involving a multi-million dollar insurance claim. This is a quirk in the law that's really stupid, but this is what the law says. If you file a fraudulent insurance claim, even though 90% of your claim is valid, the relief to the insurer is to strike in its entirety your entire claim. So in this particular case, what happened is the association apparently felt that the casualty event was a good opportunity to go ahead and to cure a lot of the building deficiencies that were discovered during the 40-year certification. Now, I don't know if you have that type of certification requirement up here in this county, but in South Florida, a lot of counties have what they call a 40-year certification. When 40 years after the building is built, they have to get in to get an engineering certification, and they found that the building is deficient in terms of its construction to bring it up to current code requirements. So we've had several buildings. In fact, it's a fairly standard defense that insurance companies raise to claims filed, and that's another problem. The claims have to be filed within the defined period of the policy. Okay, even if otherwise, you also lose your ability to, on your claims. And hopefully as part of your programs, I'm sure you've had it, you're going to have someone talk about casualty and casualty claims because it's an important area. But the associations, in this case, included in their claim inflated costs of recovery and repairs, and also repair of items that were previously existing conditions, and it was a defense verdict. And if you remind me, send me an email, I'll send you a copy of the case. You might want to put it into your, because it's a very important lesson to be learned about dealing with post-casualty insurance claims. On the other hand, in a case that my firm had handled the preparation for several years, a federal jury in Miami just found, I think it was about $23 million in damages against QBE for failing to pay claims following Hurricane, I believe it was Wilma. So, you know, there's two sides to the story, but this defense verdict does raise issues that you need to be sensitive to. Someone asked the cost of our hurricane seminar. We have a free webinar. You can log on. We had it last week. It's free of charge. You know, where you go to the site, Beckram Holikoff site, and I don't know when it's running again. We had 400 or 500 people logged on to watch it. It is a hurricane preparedness. They call it webinars. It's a video on hurricane preparedness. Again, your organization can, if you ask me for it, you can put it on your website. So you can log on to it. Remind me of that too. We'll send you the hurricane preparedness tape, and you can put it right on your website.
Yeah, there's a link on our website. We're
going to try
to do it.
Right. So we'll put this one particularly where people can just log on to Space Coast, and you can click on it and watch it. It's free of charge. There's no cost. We're happy to assist in that.
There's another webinar this next week on recovery.
Hurricane preparedness and recovery?
Now, the last one was preparedness. The one this week is recovery.
You know, we have a large organization now, and even I don't know, you know, when they're running them, but I do know that that one ran because I saw an email about it. Someone asked me a question. A great question here. These are great questions. How do you suggest the association prepare for the future use of garage electric hybrid cars? We get a lot of questions about what I've written about in the paper, I don't know if it's appeared already, about energy conservation. And there's a law, there's a state law that says that the association cannot prohibit an individual from putting clotheslines up which are deemed to be energy saving devices. Again, I don't know if this is run or not, because I often answer questions weeks or months in advance of when they actually appear in the paper. In other words, I have columns that are written already out and then go in sequence. And the individual writes me and says, our manager says that they're aware from my column that their deed restrictions that prohibit clotheslines are not enforceable. He said, but there's nothing in the law that specifically says that you have a right to hang clothes on the clothesline. And needless to say, I wrote back that that's a ridiculous interpretation of the law. It would sort of be like saying, and under the fair housing law, where you have to permit trained service animals, that means you have to allow them to have a leash for the dog, but they don't have a right to own the dog. Same thing. Needless to say, as we move to high, and the question I got this week was, as an energy-saving device, I want to be able to have a type of scooter or a motorcycle, and our association covenants preclude that. Here we're talking about hybrid cars where they're generally plugged into electrical outlets, either in a garage or in the exterior of the house. I think you'll see this as standard part of home construction in the future. And I think that we're going to have to start making accommodations for these devices the same as you have to now under federal law allow satellite dishes, which I think would be the best analogy that I can use. Prior to the advent of the Federal Communications Act, or whatever the year is now, time flies, you were able to enforce deed restrictions against individuals having antennas and satellite dishes. Of course, those are the days when the satellite dishes were humongous, and you'd see them from great distances. You travel to communities. Now they have them. I'm sure you've seen them. I'm building with others, a corporate park over in Lee County right now, and we have the poles. There's a flagpole for telephone communications. Remember, they used to have these great towers with all these devices on it. Well, this is a little flagpole with a little brass top to it, and it's the same device that used to be these very large things. And I see the satellite dishes now look like trees and planters that people put in on their balconies. So I think you're going to see this being legislated in the future, that individuals be allowed to have in the same way as we now require the permission to have satellite dishes. Now that Senate Bill 7 has been deleted, the association's what is the responsibility? I think I covered that during my talk. The association is required to carry insurance on all improvements, including unit air conditioning units. And the homeowner is required to carry insurance on their HO6 policy, HO3 in a homeowner setting, for their personally, and in a homeowner setting, obviously, for generally the house as well. And the association can currently force place insurance, which I don't recommend that they do so. Sure. Now, good question. I'm glad you asked the question. It's not maintenance, it's casualty. Exactly. Good question. I'm glad you asked for clarification. This doesn't retain, yes, I'll repeat the question. Let's not get confused with the obligation to maintain insurance for casualty with the duty to maintain. The unit owners are still responsible under documents for whatever it is that they're responsible to maintain. And that includes the unit air conditioning unit. This only means that in the event of a casualty, a hurricane, blows through and blows the air conditioning, unit air conditioning compressor off the roof or on the ground, then the cost of replacing that is covered by the association's policy. I do expect then again, I expected it this year, that in the legislation next year that will hopefully pass, that the obligation for covering the unit air conditioning will be transferred back as it previously was under the HO6 policy. Okay, I'll throw that. But as we sit here for this hurricane season, it needs to be covered by casualty only by the association.
So with this change to the coolant capacity, you know, the product that we're using for coolant, would be required to change out the stuff that the air handler as well.
Any maintenance remains the responsibility of.
So now we have a hurricane this year comes
through. Oh, I'm with you. I'm with you. Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. You'd be responsible for restoration of the whole system, including the coolant. Because of time, I'm going to only have time for more questions. If your website permits it, what I'll do as an exclusive to Space Coast is I'll answer the rest of these questions for placing on your website. Okay? And it'll take me a few weeks to get them all done, but as I get them done, I'll send them to you. And then you can give you an excuse to log on to the website to read it. And you also have it available where you can look at. I will answer all your questions and we'll have them on the website. I will be back September 26th. I think it's at the Monarch Country Club. Is that the name of a country club up here?
No.
It's somewhere up here. There's a country club where they're doing that event, and I'll find out where it is. We can do more than one. Again, you don't have to wait till September to buy new neighborhoods. It's available today, pre-order on Amazon.com. Until they have it up running right, just put polyacult in your neighborhoods. It comes right up. You can pre-order it. The price, as I said, is very cheap. It's only $11.53. I think Amazon's selling it for right now. And hopefully we'll also answer a lot of your questions. Last question tonight.
Just one question on the air conditioning follow-up. Next time we put a unit in 3 years ago and it has a SEER 13, it's time to put in 10 years ago and it has a SEER 8. I'm wanting to get your thoughts.
It's a very good question, and the question relates not only to the air conditioning unit, it also relates to a very important question, which I tell you, when I talk about insurance, and I say, if you don't learn anything from what I talk about, make sure you walk out of here and you make sure on both your homeowner policy and your association policy, so you have law and ordinance coverage. That's the single most important coverage for you to have. And what that says is in the event of a casualty loss, the repair will not be based upon what was in place at the time of the loss, but rather what is currently required by code. Okay, so if code today requires a high energy efficient air conditioning unit and you have law and ordinance coverage, in my opinion, it would be the obligation of the insured to replace that unit, regardless of what the date was or what you had in place, with the unit that is currently required to be in place by federal and state energy codes. If you don't have law and ordinance coverage, they're only going to replace you, as far as the insurance company, with what you had in place at the time of the loss.
Yeah, but if the obligation is on the board, it's on the association to replace it. How does your law and ordinance umbrella that?
It does. It's not. The association has the obligation to acquire hazard and liability coverage. And the coverage is embedded into the contract, the insurance contract, regardless of its terms. So when the state law mandates that there be certain minimum coverages, regardless of the policy terms, the state law controls over that. It's not, but the law now also says this. They also codified what they call the Plaza East decision. And this is also important. Plaza East was a declaratory opinion of the Divisional Land Sales and Condominiums that said, notwithstanding what your documents say, and what your documents used to say is in the event of a casualty loss, and the proceeds are inadequate to repair the loss, then the individual unit owner who suffered the loss is responsible for the cost. Plaza East said, which is now the law in Florida, that if the association is responsible for providing insurance coverage, whether the proceeds are adequate or not, whether the association has coverage or not, the association is obligated to repair and replace, the cost of which shall be a common expense borne by all unit owners. So if your unit alone suffered a loss as a result of a hurricane, and that which was damaged was part of the property to be covered by the association, then all unit owners in the condominium are responsible for replacing your air conditioning unit, and including your sliding glass doors, your balconies, and any of the interior of the unit to be covered by the association. And that's how it now works as we sit here today. Okay, that was just passed in 2008. So that is the law. Joy being here. I look forward to seeing you in September. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Polyakov. I have just two little announcements quickly. One, we were fortunate to have one of our business associates sponsor and make up a banner for Space Coast for advertising for the trade show and whatever, and would like to thank the Brevard Green Team for their sponsorship on that. And a quick reminder, the next meeting will be on September 26th, and we will be doing a book signing for Gary Polyakov's book, and you can pick it up prior to that meeting at Amazon.com. And there will also be a question and answer period after that if we do have the time. There will be no meetings between July and August. And thank you all for coming. And we look forward to seeing you in September.
Where is September?
Here. It's in Cocoa Beach. The new announcements program list will be on the website probably by Wednesday.
All right.